Accession number 10304, Reel 1.
Captain Habesh, Reel 1. Can you tell me, first of all, Captain, something about your family and educational background?
Well, I was born in Bridlington in East Yorkshire, and then when I was one, we moved to Rhyl in North Wales, which is where I really grew up. My father was a businessman in Rhyl. He had various interests. And I went to school, firstly, in a small prep school, a convent in Rhyl, a Catholic convent. And then I went to a boarding school, which is just outside Rhyl. And at the age of nearly 15, I went to an officer's training ship, HMS Worcester, on the Thames, which unfortunately is now defunct. And to start a course of 2 years pre-sea training to be an officer in the Merchant Navy. And I was there for the last peacetime term.
What was the education like at Worcester?
It was a public school as well as a nautical college. So we did the normal, we took our... matriculation examinations and things like that, as well as the nautical training. It was sort of divided into two. We had a nautical side and we had the scholastic side. And when you finally passed out, it was sort of six terms, 2 years. You finally passed out, you had various grades of leaving certificates, which were, as I say, were the equivalent of the school certificate and matriculation, which is what we had in those days.
And did you value your education at HMS Worcester as far as preparing you for seagoing was concerned?
Oh yes, very much so. It was a very valuable training, pre-sea training, because it knocked a year. If you were going into the Merchant Navy, it knocked a year off your cadetship or apprenticeship with the shipping company that you went to. Instead of doing 4 years apprenticeship or cadetship, you only did three. And during the war, that was brought down to about 2.5 because, obviously they wanted to get people trained up as quickly as possible.
And which year did you finish at Worcester?
1941, summer 1941.
To do what?
Oh, sorry, I then received a cadetship in T&J Harrison, a shipping company of Liverpool, a Cerenti steamship company, which is a very big shipping company, and I went to sea in the autumn of 1941 as a cadet in the shipping company.
As far as the war is concerned, can you tell me what the status of merchant seamen was during the war? What kind of impositions Her Majesty's government imposed on merchant seamen?
Well, I don't know about impositions, but it took some time to get sort of the thing organised. You've got to remember that at the beginning of the war, in 1939, the British merchant fleet was the largest in the world, and it wasn't only the largest, it was the best. We had the best ships, the biggest ships, and though I say it myself, we had the best men. If a man was at sea and he had a British master's certificate or chief engineer certificate or any sort of qualification gained under the British system, internationally it was considered the highest accolade anybody could have at sea. Now what happened in 1939, of course all ships immediately were sort of administered, they weren't administered, they were administered by their owners, But their direction of what they did, their employment, all was taken over by the government. And originally it was the Board of Trade, and then it became the Minister. There was a Ministry of Shipping, I think, at one time. And then it was the Ministry of War Transport, MOUT as it was known as, and that carried on till the end of the war. Now, as regards personnel, at the beginning of the war, merchant seamen were still free to sort of go to sea or not go to sea, which is how merchant seamen have always operated. But quite soon they brought in, I think it was called the Essential Service Order, the actual name of the Parliament, the Act of Parliament. And merchant seamen then became very special. They were not allowed to leave the sea except to go into the armed forces. Now, what happened then was people were, instead of just staying with the same shipping company, I mean, they could do, there were two things you could do. You could stay with the same owners all the time. But if you wanted to, you could go on to something called the pool, which came in about, I suppose, 1940 or something like that. Whereas a seaman, when he signed off a ship, if he didn't, re-sign a contract to go back with his own owners, he could go on the pool. And then after his leave, he had to report back to his local pool in the nearest port to where he lived, places like Liverpool, Hull, of course, Glasgow. And he would then be offered a ship. Now, he could refuse that ship, and then he would be offered another one. He could refuse that one. But if he refused a third ship, he was told, right, that's you, finished, out of the Merchant Navy, straight into the armed forces. Or, even more horrendous, he could be directed, I understand, into things like coal mines and factories and, you know, jobs like that. Of course, I never got involved in this. I was a professional full-time sailor, so I didn't want to do any of these things, you know. I did make one effort to transfer to the Royal Naval Reserve at about the middle of my cadetship. I felt I'd sooner be a midshipman in the R&R than a cadet in the Harrison line. By then, if you were over 18, as I was then, and you were in the Merchant Navy, they changed it so that you couldn't transfer to the armed forces of the Navy, because there was such a shortage of people at sea in the Merchant Navy that they needed every man they could get. And in fact, going back to the beginning of the war, most officers of the and ratings of the sort of prestigious shipping companies, big ones, automatically belonged to the Royal Naval Reserve. And of course, 1939 came, they were all called that, which left the Merchant Navy very, very short-handed of both senior and junior people. And about halfway through the war, they realised that it was far easier to take people straight from civilian life. They went into the sort of RNVR, the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, and hostilities only, as they were called, and train them up rather than take the very experienced merchant seamen who were needed to operate merchant ships. And in some cases, they were actually transferred back again to the Merchant Navy.
When you first started your career in the Merchant Navy in 1941, what was the morale amongst merchant seamen at that stage of the war?
Well, if you're young like I was, obviously it was, you know, it was a great adventure, I suppose. And coming from North Wales, and I did, the great not great majority, but there was a very sizable proportion of people from the North Wales coast traditionally went to sea. You know, I mean, Blue Funnel, for instance, the shipping company, the Liverpool shipping company, another one, it was always known as the Welsh Navy because they had so many people coming from the North Wales coast. And in my company, it was the same. And for instance, we had, I think there were about at least half a dozen, possibly more, captains called Jones, and they had to, in the Welsh manner, they had to be designated. We had Barmouth Jones, Aberystwyth Jones, One Egg a Week Jones, things like that. So there was a big tradition of Welsh people going to sea out of Liverpool. I sailed out of Liverpool throughout the war, in fact. I always thought the morale was very good. The older ones, I think, by the time I went to sea in 41, were beginning to feel the strain, there's no doubt about it. I mean, most captains in those days were quite elderly gentlemen, although as the war went on, so the age, you know, you started seeing young, beardless captains, you know, coming up, naturally. But the older ones, I thought, were, you know, they'd been at it, say, a couple of years when I of convoy duties the whole time. And it was a strain, there's no doubt about it. I'll sort of go into that perhaps a little later on, what it was like to be in a convoy crossing the North Atlantic. This had gone, I can't remember the exact date now, but I know that at the beginning of the war, if you were torpedoed, your pay ceased immediately then, and the only sort of pay you were entitled to, it didn't matter if you were weeks in an open boat before you were rescued, the only thing you were entitled to was the dole. Of course, some companies obviously kept their, you know, full-time officers and ratings on pay. But, I mean, legally, the only entitlements a merchant seaman had once he was torpedoed was the dole. He had no other, there was no such thing as, you know, shipwreck pay or anything like that at that time. But that, I think, quite soon was overtaken by, obviously, there was a public outrage at such a thing, you know. And then, of course, people became, you were on full pay, whatever happened, and then you started getting allowances for being torpedoed and outfits, you know, you were all your clothing, you know, you got a outfitting allowance and all this sort of thing. So very soon, really, I suppose, things became very much better and organized. Another thing that I think really annoyed people more than the fact that their pay ceased was the fact that in their discharge book at that time, if you were torpedoed, they put in VNC, which meant voyage not completed. Now, the categories of entries in a seaman's discharge book were VG, which is very good, and to be quite honest, that was the only stamp that any master put in that would be any good to anybody. Anything other than that was really considered a bad. There's no such thing as a bad discharge. Nobody, you weren't allowed to put in a seaman's book bad, you know, or anything like that. But if you had good, you know, everybody said, oh my gosh, it must have been awful, because the VG covered a very wide sort of spectrum. You could be, that might mean you were absolutely first-class man, you know, right down to you just managed to keep out of trouble, you know, for the whole voyage. Then there was this good, which meant really you were bad. There was what were called DR, which was very bad. That meant declined to report. But it really meant that the captain was so incensed with the behaviour of this particular chap. He didn't want to say anything about it. And finally, there was, well, not finally, there was another one, ENR, endorsement not required. That was a seaman's choice, and he could say he didn't want the captain to, you know, say anything about him. But again, that would have been considered a bad report. Rather funny, I was with one old sailor during the war. He'd been with the company something like 20-odd years, and his discharge book never had any other entry but in it but ENR, endorsement not required, because, and he was a first-class man, you know, I mean, he was a first-class seaman and well-behaved and all the rest of it. But his idea was that no captain alive was qualified enough to put in his book what he thought of this particular chap. So he had a book full of ENRs, but he was so well known, obviously, he got away with it. The final one that's coming to was this VNC, which was voyage not completed. Now, pre-war, that meant usually a fellow jumped ship somewhere. You know, he'd gone to Australia and he thought, oh, it's going to be a, you know, sheep farmer or something. Or he'd gone to Canada or America or somewhere where the lights are bright and the grass was greener, and he jumped ship. And of course they put on it VNC, voyage not completed. And that's what they put on the early days if you were torpedoed, which is a terrible thing. And then that was changed. You know, they got things sorted out. And there we were. Now, again, the beginning of the war, merchant seamen were fairly, you know, the armed forces immediately had great kudos. You know, I remember saying, oh, gosh, look, here's chaps in uniform, jolly good, we'll have canteens for them, we'll have special, you know, you'd get into cinemas or theatres half price, you know, all the rest of it. Well, this didn't apply to merchant seamen for a long time, and then it did. And gradually, you know, things improved. And you see, you've got to remember that the merchant navy was not a uniformed or a disciplined service. They were civilians. And the only uniform the ratings had, I mean, officers had uniform, petty officers, some ratings, quartermasters and stewards, people like that. They did have uniforms, but the ordinary deckhand or the engine room hand, he didn't have a uniform. But what everybody did have, they had a Merchant Navy identity card, which entitled them to certain things as the war went on. And they also had a little silver badge with MN, and that was very highly respected, actually, by the populace when they saw a chap wearing this. You could only have this badge if you were a serving merchant seaman. It was treated with great respect, and eventually the Merchant Navy was on the same status as the armed forces, and they were allowed to use the forces' canteens, for instance, and they had travel concessions and all the rest of it. You see, the Merchant Navy were the only civilians that, from the onset of the war, from the very beginning, were engaged in actual combat with the enemy. Their ships were armed, and they were taught to defend their ships with a variety of weapons, which perhaps I'll talk about a little later on. And they were expected to shoot back at the enemy, you know, even though they were civilians. Now, this was recognized, and merchant seamen were entitled to be awarded military decorations for bravery, like the DSO, for instance, DSM or anything like that. And because they were obviously in action, and there was no other civilian organization that was in this particular sort of position. The Home Guard, you see, once they, you know, Dad's Army, once they were civilians, of course, but once they put their uniform on and went on duty at night, they automatically then became part of the armed forces, you know, and this was part of the Geneva Convention. And so it was with merchant seamen. Under the Geneva Convention, you were allowed to defend your ship. But you weren't allowed to actually attack. You know, you had to let the enemy attack you first, which is why in the beginning of the war, all merchant ships were armed only abaft the bridge. You had sort of machine guns, Bofors guns, things like that for anti-aircraft thing, up to the bridge, and your big weapon was a 4-inch or a 4.7. So I believe some of the very big liners actually had 6-inch guns on. But the normal ships had a 4.7, I think it was, anti-submarine gun on the stern. You weren't allowed to have it on the bow. Now, when the Americans came in the war in 1941, they had no such inhibitions. I remember seeing, even before they came in the war, they started to arm their ships because their ships were being sunk in the North Atlantic. And American warships were helping to escort convoys to Iceland anyway, between Iceland and the United States, because, you know, we just didn't have the escorts to do all this. And I noticed their merchant ships, and my first trip to see America wasn't in the war, you know. And their ships were armed fore and aft. They had just as many guns fore on the bow as on the stern. And by another year, by 1942, then British ships were starting to be... I mean, it was ridiculous not to arm them forward at the bridge as well, because if an aircraft could, you know, obviously attack them, they knew where the guns were. And, of course, they very rarely attack from the stern. You know, they always attack from the bow. And, of course, as the same with a submarine or a surface craft was attacking a merchant ship. I mean, they wouldn't get round the stern. They knew there was a gun there. They'd come at you from forward of the beams, I mean. My first trip to sea, as I said, was in the autumn of 1941. And I joined my ship in Liverpool, sent on a gunnery course immediately. I was coming back again to our, you know, defending the ships. Every seaman in between voyages, or when he was, before the ship sailed, they were all sent on these two-day gunnery courses, which you had a variety of weapons to train on, and we fired at targets. I believe that the pilots who flew the aircraft in the vicinity of the Merchant Navy gunnery schools had exceedingly... higher risk to run, you know, in cases they were shooting nearer the aircraft than the target, but there it was. And my first trip to sea, of course, all the ships leaving Britain, or nearly all the ships leaving Britain, had very little in them going to America, as ballast mainly. But this particular ship I was in was called the Settler, the Atlantean, not Settler. Settler was my second ship. And we had to go out to Ellesmere Port to load two, I think they were 15-inch guns. Anyway, they were very large guns for one of our battleships that was refitting in Norfolk Navy Yard, America, under Lend-Lease or whatever. As I say, it was before America was in the war. And we crossed the Atlantic in, very luckily, nothing happened except bad weather, of course. When we reached 30 West, I remember, the Americans took over. And, of course, they were still in peace, and all their warships were gleaming, you know, as warships are in peacetime. I'm afraid our escorts were sad-looking, rust-streaked, you know, paint peeling off, as were the merchant ships. I mean, we had very little chance to tiddly up ships in wartime. And I remember these, well, to us, it was an enormous sort of fleet of warships came compared to what we had. You know, we had, I think it was one destroyer and three corvettes was the escort. There were about 50 ships in the convoy. And there seemed to be just as many American ships, and they came steaming down the columns, you know, music blaring out of the loudspeakers, everything gleaming, brass shining, and there were shouts through the, loud hailers from these ships, so, hey, you guys, wish we were in there with you, which was not very nice of them. And we went to Norfolk, we discharged these guns, and then we went down the east coast of the United States picking up cargo for UK, and the southern ports mainly, Charleston, Savannah, Jacksonville. And the Americans, the further you went south, were more pro-British than up north. And I was quite surprised to find that they were still fighting the Civil War down there, you know, and because we'd backed the South in the Civil War, we could do no wrong. We had far better treatment in American ports, and this was before they were in the war, as seamen going ashore, than we did in, say, Liverpool, you know. We got free passes on all the buses, cinemas were free to us, and people fell over themselves to entertain us and look after us. I still have friends from my first trip to sea in Jacksonville. And this family, of course, the parents long since gone, but the eldest daughter was a teenager. We still not only correspond, we visited each other, you know, and this is after, 41, 47 years, you know, we're still great buddies. So they were very, very friendly people. The second time I crossed the Atlantic, of course, America was in the war then. In fact, we were coming back on UK, fully loaded, of course, in a convoy from Halifax to Liverpool when Pearl Harbor happened. You know, the next trip was I had to lead the Atlantean because I went down with German measles halfway home. So I obviously had to go into hospital when we arrived in Liverpool. Anyway, my next ship was a Settler, which is a troop ship. It was a cargo ship turned into a small troop ship. And we took VIPs and people going to join ships in America, ferry pilots being taken back to the States, having flown aircraft across. Coming back, we always had RAF people, you know, done all their training in America with the training schemes that America was doing, even before they were in the war, and of course it got more and more as the war went on. And we used to bring all these Canadian and British pilots. They're all air crew, a whole lot. So we were an RAF trip ship, really.
Do the names of any of the VIPs stick out in your mind?
No, not really. I know we carried an MP one occasion, but he must... obviously not a well-known one. And we had diplomats and people like that used to go across. One trip we did, that's quite an interesting problem. One trip we did, we carried kids, you know, these evacuees. And we were very worried when we heard about this. Obviously, you know, we were going to have something like 100 children and their escorts to go to Canada. Actually, we were going to Canada on this trip, to Halifax. And we're all very worried about this, you know, because the city of Benares has been torpedoed and with very heavy loss of life of children in the North Atlantic. And we're very worried about this, you know, and we say, my God, I hope we don't get torpedoed, you know. And after this tribe had been on board about 2 days, we were hoping we would be. They were the most awful crowd, honestly. They were uncontrollable. We talk about young people today, you should have seen this lot, and this was in 1942.
What were they doing?
Oh, crikey, they were running around, I was on the bridge on watch one day and with the chief officer, and he suddenly went puce, you know, in his face. Go on, stop that, sir, sir. And there was a small boy, about 8, I suppose, 9 maybe, hanging out